Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Today, we'll get tastes of Asia from both an Asian American and travelers. Then we'll look at Chinese food from the Jewish point of view. So let's dig in. Julie O'Hara is a freelance food and travel writer and has a blog called A Mingling of Tastes. She has written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about the wondrous foods she ate in Southeast Asia and how she's recreated them at home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. She joins me today from member station WLRN. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Bonnie.
So you've written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about this trip you took and recreating these foods back home. Do you do that a lot when you travel?
Yeah. My favorite thing to do when I travel is to eat the food, even more than going to museums. And I love art. I love to see art museums when I travel. But even more than that, the food to me is, you know, a truly authentic experience. And it's something that you can't replicate exactly back home.
Where were you in Southeast Asia?
Well, we started off in Singapore, and then we went on to Bangkok, and then to Vietnam, where we were in Ho Chi Minh City and Nha Trang.
Wow. Was there a country where you thought the food was best?
Vietnam, absolutely.
And why? What was it about the Vietnamese food that stood out?
I think we had a higher ratio of good quality meals. You know, in Thailand, it was very spotty. Sometimes you'd have a great noodle dish, and sometimes it would just be dripping with oil and, you know, not so hot. But in Vietnam, I thought it was good quality, and I love the subtlety of the flavor. The lemongrass, the shallots, the garlic, the mint. It's very aromatic and subtle, not as reliant on chilies and spices, you know, hot spices.
Right. Had you eaten a lot of Vietnamese food in the United States before you went?
Not enough. I've had pho, you know, the noodle soup and, you know, the Vietnamese spring rolls, but not really.
Talk about pho a little bit. That is a common dish served in the U.S.,
Yeah, in Vietnam, it's, you know, one of the major, you know, national dishes, and it's kind of like their chicken soup, at least in my opinion. It's this long simmered stock made usually with, you know, a very flavorful cut of beef. And so you make the stock over days and days, and it's flavored with cloves and other spices like that. And then when it's served with noodles, and you get this huge plate of fresh herbs like lime leaves, cilantro, mint, basil, bean sprouts, and you can flavor your soup with all those herbs to your liking. It's wonderful.
How did you find the restaurants that you went to?
A combination of a lot of things. Some of it was just serendipity, you know, kind of what looks good. Do you see a lot of local people there? Does it look like the cooks know what they're doing and turn out the meals really quickly and freshly? We also just used guidebooks, like our Lonely Planet guidebook. It was really helpful, actually, in finding a lot of places. That's mostly how we did it.
How did you do with the language?
You know, a lot of people know English, especially in the city. Like in Bangkok, a lot of Thais know at least rudimentary English. And then in Vietnam, tourism is such a major industry there that, at least in the city, a lot of people will have some English. So it's not that bad. And, you know, occasionally you'll encounter a restaurant you want to eat at and the menu's totally in another language. And you kind of just point at the table next to you and you say, I want what he's eating. And, you know, it's an adventure. So.
Did you talk to the waiters or the owners about how the foods were cooked and get some insight into the cuisine?
I would often try to ask. Sometimes there was a little language barrier, but like in one restaurant in Bangkok, I had this amazing Thai green curry. It's a curry made with coconut milk and, you know, either shrimp or chicken and a lot of vegetables, and I loved it. It's one of those, you know, common Thai dishes. You know, you'll see it here in Thai restaurants, but it looked so different to me and it tasted so good and authentic. I wanted to know what was in it, and these vegetables were floating around in the curry that looked like giant peas. And I asked the waiter what they were, and he said they were eggplant, and I thought he just didn't understand me, but he assured me that, no, these were little miniature Asian eggplants, and I was so upset because I knew I could never find these again in the States, and it was tragic to me that I'd never be able to eat that green curry the way it tasted in Bangkok.
Have you tried to recreate that dish in the States?
I have, and what you really just need to do is find a good curry paste. And if you go to some Asian grocery stores, you know, look for the stuff that's imported from Thailand. Usually it comes in a little can. And once you've got that, I mean, that's all your flavor. You mix it with some coconut milk, you add chicken, you know, and you can use Asian eggplants. You know, they're not quite the same, but they're still very good. And, you know, you're pretty much set once you have that curry paste.
Was it hard to replicate some of the dishes that you wanted to copy when you got home?
Yes, some were a lot harder. I fell in love with the clay pot stews that they would make in Vietnam. And my husband and I started to say, like, if something comes in a clay pot, it's going to be delicious. Order it. So they, you know, they make these stews, and there's this balance of sweet and pungent in the broth, and it's just wonderful, you know, slowly simmered in the oven. And I ate as many of them as I could so I could come home and see if I could replicate the flavor. And, you know, I tried several times at home, and I finally, you know, found a good balance that I think really tastes like the stews I remember. And you have to use fish sauce, but balance it with sugar. And I also recently learned that they use caramel syrup a lot in Vietnamese cuisine. And that's just, you know, make a caramel with sugar and water, you know, simmer it until it caramelizes. And that gives that richness and a little more sweetness. So, you know, that's kind of a French technique, actually, that the Vietnamese picked up when they were a French colony.
Did you see a lot of French influence in the food you ate in Vietnam?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, there's the caramel syrup. You see baguettes on the street. Vendors sell baguette sandwiches. And, you know, that's absolutely a direct carryover from the French. And you can order wine in restaurants in Vietnam, whereas in Thailand, you'd have to be in an Americanized restaurant to get a good bottle of wine. It's very hard to find wine in Thailand. But in Vietnam, you get French wine almost everywhere.
Isn't that interesting? And what do you get in Thailand? Beer?
Beer, absolutely. And that's what you want to drink with those hot dishes anyway.
Sure, so, absolutely. Did you eat things that were new to you?
Yeah, all over the place. And something new that I never had before was one of my favorite meals from our trip. It was in Singapore, and it was at the East Coast Seafood Center, which is this kind of massive park on, you know, the east coast of the island. Singapore is just a really huge island, city on an island. And you get this whole crab, and they smother it with either your choice of chili sauce or black pepper sauce. And the really famous one is the chili sauce. And, you know, you just get this huge crab in a dish covered in sauce. So it's like, don't wear a white shirt, you know, cover yourself in a garbage bag. You're going to get sauce all over you. And it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. And that one's kind of sweet, but I loved the black pepper one. And you think it's going to almost hurt to eat that much black pepper. You can see the black chunks in the sauce, but it's wonderful. It lets you really appreciate how subtle and flavorful of a spice that pepper really is.
Was the food in Singapore distinctive?
Yes. Singapore, I think, is a great gastronomical destination, actually. It's a melting pot of Chinese, Indian, Malaysian, and native Singaporeans, and they all bring their food together in this tiny little city-state, you know? And so you go to a hawker center, and that's where everybody eats in Singapore. Even the locals, they don't cook so much in their little apartments because they can go to a hawker center, which is kind of like a big outdoor food court. And, you know, the hawkers are the individual cooks that have stalls, and they sell their specialty dishes. But, you know, the quality is excellent, and it's very inexpensive. And when you're traveling in Asia, people, you know, sometimes want to warn you about eating street vendor food. But in Singapore, the hawker centers are all regulated by the government, and they have, you know, safety health standards that they have to live up to. And, you know, everything in Singapore is very closely regulated. It's very clean. It's very safe. And the same goes for the food. So it's a no-risk situation.
Have you found, since you came back from this trip, that you're doing more Southeast Asian cooking?
Yes, definitely. When we first got back to the States, all we wanted to eat was hamburgers. It was ridiculous. But that lasted for only about a week. And then we wanted those flavors again, you know, those aromatic flavors and the spices. I mean, I like medium spicy food. My husband likes really spicy food. And I've developed an even greater taste and a craving for the hot chilies. I love it.
Julie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Bonnie. I really enjoyed it.
That was freelance food writer Julie O'Hara from Fort Lauderdale. Jennifer Ate Lee was born in America but ate traditional Chinese foods at home. So she was perplexed by the dishes in Chinese restaurants. The food in the little white takeout boxes was so different from the meals her mom prepared. This led her to write a book called The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, Adventures in the World of Chinese Food. She talks with NPR's Michelle Norris.
My interest started when I was about 13, and I found out that fortune cookies weren't Chinese. And it was sort of this disconcerting discovery, like I was adopted and there was no Santa Claus at the same time. In a way, I had bought into the myth of what is, quote unquote, really Chinese.
When and how did you discover that fortune cookies were not Chinese?
I actually read it in a book called The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. And in it, there are two women who go work in a fortune cookie factory, and one of them has never seen fortune cookies and thinks that the messages that are in them are completely ridiculous. And it was really at that moment, I was like, I even asked my mom, I'm like, Mom, did you know they weren't Chinese?
And then there was, of course, the story about the Powerball lottery, the mega jackpot lottery, where 104 people all came up with the same six numbers.
Yes, on March 30th, 2005, an inordinate number of people became second place winners. And as the people started doing the discovery of the reason why, they discovered it had to do with fortune cookies across the entire country, across men, women, old, young. And to me, the universality of the fact that all these people had played the same fortune cookie lucky number on the same day spoke volumes about the institutionality of Chinese food in American life.
So you set out to actually go back and try to find some of the restaurants where these people had their dinner and where they got the fortune cookies. You also take us in reading the book into the world of fortune cookies, how they're made. And we discover that all those fortunes inside all those cookies are all connected to two people.
Yes. The large majority of fortunes basically come from two places. One from a factory called Wonton Food, which is in Long Island City. And I would say they're responsible for about half of all fortune cookie messages. Then there's another guy named Stephen Yang, who doesn't really even speak English, who's out on the West Coast. And he, in a sort of one or two room garage type warehouse, furnishes maybe 40% of the fortunes in America. He's sort of the outsourced person for all the kind of wisdom. And you can usually recognize his stuff. A lot of it's red, and a lot of it has sort of smiley faces in it.
Wisdom. Interesting word there. He dispenses wisdom through these
Yes, he is a fortune cookie sage. And it's funny because he doesn't even really speak English. He hires other people to be sort of outsourced, like, you know, Confucius's, to write them on his behalf.
And it turns out that writing fortunes is really not just an art, but really a science. It takes quite a bit to get it right.
Yeah, because you have to basically sort of summarize the essence of something into a sentence that's or two that's no more than 12 words long. And you want it to be both punchy and memorable and also broadly applicable enough to enough people that they don't complain. And what's really funny is, of course, that a lot of fortune cookie wisdom is not Chinese at all, because a lot of Chinese wisdom doesn't port very well into American society. So, for example, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, which is sort of the American saying. The Chinese version is Chang Dao Chu Hou Niao, which means the bird whose head sticks out gets shot. And so that's a very interesting contrast in sort of the Chinese perspective on the world and the American perspective on the world. So you want the cookies to appeal to Americans.
Don't call attention to yourself.
Right.
You know, it's interesting in the book you note that some of the fortunes actually strike people the wrong way. Maybe they delight one group of people. They actually elicit complaints from others. And one, you note that you will soon inherit a large sum of money. It seems to be good news, but people thought that it was auguring the death of a loved one.
Indeed. There are a bunch of different ways that fortunes can be differently interpreted. Another common one is, you know, there is a, you know, dark, mysterious man in your future. It might be great to serve a Sex and the City type of woman, but very, very different to like a six-year-old girl who gets it.
Oh, sounds like the boogeyman.
Yeah, totally. And so, or, you know, lighten up sounds like, you know, cheer up. But if it's someone who might have be sensitive about their weight, that might not also go so well. So they kind of, in a way, want fortunes that are bland. And the goal is to not get complaints about the fortune. It's not necessary to be as wise and succinct, you know, and pointed as possible, as much as it is to minimize audience complaints.
How do the complaints make their way back to the company?
Well, the way that the complaints make their way up is the patron often complained to the restaurant. Everyone wants everyone to have a happy fortune in the end, because that's how they get good tips. And so the restaurateurs then complain to the fortune cookie distributor. The fortune cookie distributor then complains to the manufacturer, who then, you know, complains to either Stephen Yang or Wanton Food and says, dude, you know, this fortune got a complaint all the way down the line. And they do a pretty good job of sort of excising them.
Now, you also note in the book that when they actually tried to take fortune cookies, very popular to America, back to China and back to Japan, they didn't do very well. They were essentially told, we can't market these things. They're too American.
Right. Basically, from the Chinese perspective, they have plenty of ways to tell fortunes. I mean, you can get, you know, someone who reads your face, who reads your palm, who reads tea leaves. You can go to a temple and, like, you know, pull out a stick that gives you a fortune. So they don't really need an upstart cookie, if that makes sense. And also, the other interesting thing about fortune cookies in America is they are almost historically universally positive. Whereas in China and in Japan, if you go get a fortune taken, about half the time, it's fairly negative. And that they actually think that's good, right? Because it's only by getting negative feedback can you kind of engage in, like, self-improvement in your life. But in America, which tends to be a very optimistic society, that doesn't always go off so well.
Mm, the Lake Wobegon effect in a fortune cookie.
Yes.
You began this book as a quest to understand Chinese food and Chinese culture, but it sounds like it turned into a journey of self-exploration. What did you, in the end, learn about yourself and learn about the country, America, the country that your parents had adopted?
Well, the thing that really struck me in the end is that China, in a way, is the largest immigrant-producing country in the world, and America is the largest immigrant-accepting country in the world. And what I thought was really interesting is when people talked to me on the phone, if they didn't know my last name, they would always think I was, quote, American. But upon seeing me, sometimes people would be like, oh, you're Chinese. It was really interesting to understand the disconnect in people's minds, that a voice and just a name, you know, Jennifer, is in essence American. But on, you know, the surface, I look Chinese. And in a way, I'm a lot like dishes that exist only in America but that look Chinese, like General Tso's chicken, because while they look Chinese, they exist really only in America or exist mainly in America. Fortune cookies, like, people think of them as Chinese, but they are fundamentally something that's American. So what the book does and what it made me think twice about and what I hope it makes everyone think twice about is, quote, you know, what does it mean to be American? That we might be shifting away from sort of a Eurocentric view of the United States into something that's, you know, much more multicultural, multinational. And Chinese food is just one slice of that.
Jennifer Ait Lee, it's been a pleasure talking to you. All the best to you.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Ait Lee, her book is due out in March. It's called The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, Adventures in the World of Chinese Food. And you can read an excerpt at our website, npr.org.
Chinese food has been a second cuisine to American Jews for centuries. Scholars have tried to figure out why, and Professor Don Siegel has written a book on the subject, From Lokshen to Lo Mein. Lokshen are Jewish noodles, and Lo Mein are Chinese noodles. Don Siegel joins NPR's Ari Shapiro from a Chinese restaurant in Cicero, New York.
Hi, Professor Siegel.
Hello, how you doing, Ari?
I'm great. Well, I want to start with a quip that you write on the first page of your book. It says, Chinese history dates back about 5,000 years, and Jewish culture dates back about 6,000 years. The question is, how could the Jews survive for the first 1,000 years without Chinese food? What's with this intense bond between Jews and Chinese food? Why not, you know, Thai or Japanese or Hungarian food?
It's a great question. And to be honest, no one really knows the exact reasons. Back in 1990s, there were a couple sociologists, Gay Tookman and Harry Levin, who published a paper on this. They're sociologists from New York, and they suggested three possible reasons. The first being that Jews, when they immigrated to New York, were near the Chinatown, proximate to Chinatown.
Just geographical proximity.
That's right, and so and plus the desire to integrate with the great melting pot. The other idea was that perhaps the foods are fairly common, garlic and onions and cabbage and so forth. And the last one is the one that I think is probably most likely, which is the concept of safe treif.
Explain that. Treif, of course, is food that's not kosher, that observant Jews don't eat.
That's right. Safe treif are things such as pork and shellfish and not mixing milk with meat. And the idea is that Jews could go to Chinatown, wherever they might be, in enclaves around the world, and they could eat vegetarian, they could select foods that didn't have pork and shrimp and other shellfish in it, And then furthermore, there was this concept that if they couldn't identify the food as it's chopped up in an ingredient, say egg rolls, that if you couldn't identify it, that it was considered safe treif. The rabbis don't particularly agree with this interpretation.
Well, you know, you write in your book about your mother, who strictly followed the Jewish dietary laws when she was at home. But when she would go out for Chinese food on Christmas or other days, she would order shrimp and lobster sauce, which is about the least kosher thing you could think of. How does this operate?
Oh, it's very interesting. You know, Mom would do that. You know, she would go out. We'd go out once a year or twice a year, usually once on Christmas, and she'd eat shrimp and lobster sauce. And you find that quite a few Jews who aren't of, I guess you'd say, the Orthodox group, the conservative and reform, will often keep kosher at home. But when they leave home, for a variety of reasons, they seem to eat shellfish, but very often will not eat the pork. So, you know, I guess it's just their own personal secular interpretation of what the dietary laws are all about.
You know, Professor Don Siegel, I was thinking about Jewish kreplach and Chinese wontons, which are essentially the same food. They're dough wrapped around a bit of meat that you deep fry or you put in soup. Is this just coincidence, or is there actually a real connection there?
I think it's a coincidence. If you look at the cultural traditions all around the world, taking some dough and wrapping around a meat or vegetable product, you know, is pretty ubiquitous, I think, with culinary cuisines. You have the ravioli in Italy, you know, the kreplach, as you said, of the Jewish cuisine, the wontons of Chinese cuisine. So I just think that happens to be a coincidence.
Although you also write in your book about the Silk Road and how travelers would bring things, intermingling the foods and the cultures.
That's a good point. You know, the Jews did go to China during the Crusades. They were fleeing the Crusades. And, in fact, Jews got to China before Marco Polo himself. There was an active community in Canton, or Quanzhong, as it's known now. And so there might have been some culinary, you know, transmissions there. There's one interesting culinary transmission, if I may, that during the Song Dynasty, Jews that converted were given Chinese surnames, and one of the surnames was Li, and the other one is Jin. And I have a PhD student whose name is Li Jin from China, and she explained to me how her family doesn't eat pork. They don't know why, and this goes back generations. And on celebratory dinners, they cook a dinner of a lamb stew with onions and garlic and peppers, no soy, no ginger, and that is a Sephardic Jewish dish out of either Portugal or Spain. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
You know, Professor Siegel, I just need to note that although you have gained some measure of celebrity for your expertise in Chinese-Jewish culinary connections here, your professional life doesn't actually have anything to do with this. You are an earth science professor.
Yeah, I'm an earth science professor of I'm told, some note, and I've written, you know, like most professors of my seniority, you know, hundreds of papers and books and so on. And whenever I go to a conference, whenever I'm introduced as the guy who wrote the Chinese cookbook.
That was NPR's Ari Shapiro with Professor Don Siegel, author of From Lukshin to Lo Mein. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.